everyone. Welcome to another episode of Hashing Out the Law. I'm your host, Arash Hashemi. On this episode, my guest is Mr. William McLean Greeley. I hope I got that correct. Mr. Greeley is an author, amongst other things, and he's here to discuss his newest book, but I'm going to let him take us through that journey. Mr. Greeley, how are you?
I'm doing great today. Thank you, Arash, for having me on your program.
Thank you for being on. I'm actually very excited to have you on. We talked before and you wrote a book, and the subject of the book is actually one of your ancestors, correct me if I'm wrong. And the title of the book is Connecticut Yankee Goes to Washington, correct?
That's right.
Okay.
Subtitle is Senator George P. McLean, Birdman of the Senate.
Right. And we'll get into that. I know why that's the title of it, because I know what the book is about. Mm-hmm. But let's talk about how you started your journey and what led you to make you want to write this book.
Right. Well, this is the subject of my book is my great-great uncle. My middle name is McLean, and I grew up with very little knowledge of who this man was. And I'd ask my parents, you know, why did they give me this middle name of McLean? And their answers were never very satisfactory. And I come to find out that he's pretty much forgotten within my family for a variety of reasons. But one of the main reasons he was overlooked is he became something of a pariah in my family for his politics. He was a Republican during the era of Theodore Roosevelt, the progressive era, which is really the party of reform in that time in American history. But some of his stances on issues didn't set well within my family. For example, he opposed the League of Nations while he was in the U.S. Senate, which was the forerunner of the United Nations. And that was kind of an unforgivable sin in my family. And he was a Republican during this era. And my father loved Franklin Delano Roosevelt for good reason. There's a lot to love about FDR. But part of that love was a dislike of just about any Republican predecessor to FDR. So for those reasons, I think he was kind of a black sheep or a pariah in my family. And I wanted to learn more about him. I wanted to get to know his life story. He was in the U.S. Senate for 18 years, from 1911 to 1929. He was also governor of Connecticut from 1900 to 1902. And I wanted to just come to know who he was as a person, what made him tick, what else he accomplished beyond sponsoring this very important conservation legislation in 1918.
Now, let me ask you this. Before you decided to write this book, had you written any other books or have you written anything before?
This is my first book. When I was in college, I wanted to be a history professor when I graduated. That was my goal. And I got as far as a master's degree. And I said, you know, I got to take a break from all this education and get a real job. And I got a job in market research at an advertising agency with the idea that I'd go back to school. My father was a history teacher, but I kind of fell in love with business and market research. It took me a lot of different places, some corporations, some government work, advertising agency. And so when I retired, I guess I got back to my first love of history. And in some ways, what I wrote was the PhD thesis that I had always had in mind. And that's the subject of my book. And it also just pulled together a lot of the interests that I've accumulated over my life.
So how did you go about finding material to write about the book? I know you said he was a pariah in your family. So I'm assuming the family didn't keep any of his documents or any of his archives around. Where did you start your journey to get what you need to complete your book?
Yeah, it began with a PowerPoint presentation for a family reunion. There were about 150 of us extended family members, many of whom also share this middle name of McLean. And I put together a fairly extensive PowerPoint about him. And that actually served as the outline of my book subsequently. But I found so much fascinating material about him. The eight presidents that he knew, five of them he knew very well, advised in the White House, went hunting and fishing with four of them. His stances on all of the key issues of the day, he voted on three constitutional amendments, 17th, 18th, 19th. He was involved in shaping the Federal Reserve Board. Many of the issues of the progressive era he weighed in on. And this was received rather well at my reunion. And one of my cousins said, hey, you know, why don't you write a book? And so I thought, well, I'll just write something that I can take to Kinko's and send it to my family members who were there. I got an editor, and the editor said, you know, I think this story really resonates beyond just your family. And he helped me shape it into a presentable manuscript. I found a publisher, the Rochester Institute of Technology Press. It's a school in New York, and they helped me further shape it into something I'm really proud of.
That's awesome. It seems like that your great uncle wasn't just a normal politician who served in the Senate one term and then went on his way. He was actually a power hitter. He was a major player back in the day. Is that correct?
He was. He was a state legislator at the age of 25. He was a federal prosecutor. He was U.S. attorney for Connecticut from when he was 35. Then he was governor of the state. And he had ambitions to run for president. And I think those were really serious ambitions. They got derailed because as a reform-minded governor, he was very unpopular with his own party because he came out for some really controversial reforms. And they felt he lost their support. And I think that really derailed his presidential ambitions. It threw him into a real tailspin. He went into a really serious period of depression when he left the governor's office. And for 8 years, he kind of regrouped and healed and came out of that with this idea that he would run for the U.S. Senate. And there, I think he really found his niche. He wasn't really an executive, as proved during his time as governor. He didn't like the patronage. He didn't like making speeches and at the chicken dinners, you know, and opening up monuments and so on. And I think he really loved the Senate because of his studious nature. He did really great committee work. He was very good at problem solving, bipartisan problem solving, which I think really resonates with us today. That's one of the big themes coming out of my book was this was really a period where Democrats and Republicans came together and overcame the polarization that so haunted this country in the years leading up to his. I mean, the Civil War was, there was never a time when we were more polarized. And he was of a generation after that, that I think was really committed to putting behind us this polarization and bringing people together to solve critical problems for the American people.
I like the fact that he didn't like to be the person who's opening monuments, and he liked to be the person doing the grunt work, for lack of better term. Excuse me. Now let's talk about the second part of the title of your book. You refer to him as the Birdman. Why is that?
His maiden speech in the U.S. Senate was on the subject of protecting birds. And the reason that was so important was in the decades leading up to his election to the Senate in 1911, birds were under tremendous threat from excessive hunting. There were really four factors that led to that. You know, birds have always been hunted as a food source since the beginning of time. But sometime after the Civil War, it became fashionable to wear feathers on women's hats primarily. And the growing population after the Civil War, there was really a population explosion, meant that birds were being hunted for food and also for the feather trade. And coupled with that was the advent of the automatic shotgun around 1890. And so at that point, hunters became killing machines. And the hunting of birds went from hundreds of thousands per year to millions to tens of millions. And many birds were on the fast track to extinction. You might have heard about the passenger pigeon went extinct. We had an endemic parrot in the United States called the Carolina parakeet that went extinct, and several other key high-profile bird extinctions, but many others were on a fast track for extinction, like the snowy egret, the flamingo, the trumpeter swan. So McLean was dedicated to putting an end to this excessive hunting, but this was the problem. States were free to set their own hunting laws and enforce them however they wanted at this time in American history. It was a states' rights versus federal government argument, in essence. McLean wanted to bring federal protection to birds, set national standards, and enforce them. And this opened up a tremendously important debate within our country about states' rights versus federal government. And that, to me, is what's really significant about this, is the passage of this legislation really led to what we now know as of the federal government's watchdog role in environmental and conservation matters. This really paved the way for that.
So his work wasn't just important because it saved birds. It set the precedence for issues that would later come on where it was the states' rights versus the federal rights, correct?
Absolutely. I think it paved the way for such legislation as the Environmental Protection Act, the Endangered Species Act, the Animal Welfare Act. All these things came subsequently, because before that, states were setting their own hunting laws and environmental laws. For instance, Arash, the state of Missouri had one hunting law at one time in the late 1800s. That was, you could not hunt on Sunday. Otherwise, you could hunt whatever you wanted, however much, at any time of the year. And it became very popular to have a spring hunting season where very wealthy hunters would come to these resorts in Missouri and elsewhere to hunt birds in the spring when they were nesting, sitting, incubating eggs. And it was like a stock pond for fishing. And it was very profitable to host these hunters. And so many states wanted to hang on to this spring hunting season. And the other issue was hunting for hats. You know, at one time in 1910, 128,000 people were employed in making hats using these kinds of feathers. Many were immigrants, entrepreneurial women. You couldn't blame them for wanting to meet this market demand. But as a consequence, many of these very beautiful birds like egrets and swans, flamingos, were hunted without any restraint to meet this demand for hats.
How long did it take for him to accomplish his goal and get this legislation passed?
Yeah, it took 7 years. And the legislation morphed and changed over this period of time. Initially, it was only aimed at the United States laws on hunting. McLean and others knew that this was going to be struck down by the U.S. Supreme Court on that basis. So they did a workaround, and this is what I found fascinating. The real genius of this legislation was they put it in the context of a treaty, as the title implies, is a Migratory Bird Treaty Act. And treaties are not subject to the Supreme Court's challenge because of the supremacy clause of the U.S. Constitution. And so this was the way they were able to overcome this expected U.S. Supreme Court challenge, by putting it in the context of a series of treaties. And I think that's kind of the genius that I found in this legislation. And furthermore, it was international in scope, because these treaties were with Canada and Mexico and other countries, and birds migrate. So having laws that only pertain to the United States would have fallen far short of the goal of really protecting birds wherever they are in their migratory cycle.
Did they have a problem getting Mexico and Canada on board with these treaties?
Well, that's a great question, because it was signed in 1918. And as you know, the U.S. was at war in Europe. That was our peak participation. July of 1918, this was signed. And so even despite the fact they were at war, McLean formed a working partnership with President Woodrow Wilson, who was from the opposite political party, which is stunning in itself. The two of them were so committed to this that they had these treaties signed despite the fact we were at war. with Great Britain was the primary signee for Canada. Now, at that time, Mexico had been desired to become a signature, but we were essentially at a war with Mexico during this time period, you know, the Pancho Villa excursions into Mexico. So we didn't sign that treaty until many years later.
I see. Now, I know it got signed when World War I was happening, but I also know that Teddy Roosevelt was a big proponent of national parks and saving the environment. He was actually he was the one who started the national parks. Did he have a role to play in this, meaning that he used his role as president while he was in office to ignite this treaty?
Yes, McLean and Roosevelt were friends. They had a very similar outlook about the environment. They were both originally hunters, and they say hunters make some of our best conservationists because they see the importance of keeping birds and animals plentiful. So the two knew each other very well. They were close. McLean was interviewed by Roosevelt to be his Secretary of the Navy in 1902 when he ascended the presidency after McKinley was assassinated. They hunted together. I found some materials that show how close they were. And so I think he was influential in the sense that they had that similar outlook. Where they differed was McLean eventually renounced hunting because he saw the automatic shotgun as being so dangerous for hunting. It was put birds and other animals at such a disadvantage. They also differed in that McLean was much more of a centrist and more moderate figure in the Republican Party. Roosevelt veered off, actually left the party in 1912, formed his own party called the Progressive Party or the Bull Moose Party. And I think at that point, the two really diverged. McLean was a very loyal, moderate, kind of a George H.W. Bush Republican. And Roosevelt was really quite, I don't want to say radical, but he definitely inhabited that more extreme part of the party. And then when he left, I think that was just too much for McLean, that he actually left the Republican Party.
Now, let's get back to McLean. So he serves his term in the Senate and he passes this wonderful legislation. What happens afterwards? By that, I mean, could you tell us about the rest of his life, you know, towards the end of his life and his legacy, please?
Yeah, I think his legacy is certainly measured in terms of the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. But beyond that, you know, I think he helped create this bipartisan effort within the Senate to pass so much legislation during the Progressive Era. And he was there from 1918 to 1929. He helped shape the Federal Reserve Board. He was very independent in his views and in his actions. It's hard to pigeonhole him as a conservative or as a progressive. For instance, in the 1920s, he didn't give in to this isolationism that was so prevalent during that time. He argued for modernizing the military after World War I. And what he meant was dedicate more to submarines and aircraft, which was very, very prescient in terms of how the military actually developed. All of his proposals were not acted upon. There was actually a cut in any kind of military spending after World War I. But I found that fascinating that he saw the value of those types of military commitments in the early 20s and argued hard for increased spending in modernizing the military at that time. Now, a cynic might say that where are submarines built? In Connecticut. but you could also say that you know, good politics is rooted in just, you know, common sense types of approaches that also benefit your constituency. But he was very independent in his functioning. He helped with a lot of tax reform in the 1920s. I mean, taxes went to very, very high levels during World War I to finance the war. And after the war was over, there was a general consensus that taxes should be lowered into the 1920s. And he took the approach that we need to retain the progressive income system. But many in his party wanted to do away with the income tax altogether and replace it with a national sales tax. And so in many ways, it was moderate figures like McLean who preserved the progressive income tax, but wanted to lower the rates so that we could recover from this depression that occurred after World War I. And I admire that. I think, in other words, he didn't give in to the extreme element of his party to say, let's do away with the income tax, replace it with the national sales. But at the same time, he said, we need to lower the rates so that we can re-stimulate the economy, and which is what happened in the 1920s. It was a tremendous, it was a great area of prosperity for the country, in large part, I think, because of the lowering of those tax rates after World War I.
Now, I noticed that you mentioned he left the Senate in 29. Did that have to do anything with the crash, or was it just a coincidence?
Well, it's probably a coincidence. He was 71 years old when he left the Senate. Many of his constituents wanted him to run for another term, but his health was declining. He'd had a heart attack. He actually only lived another 3 years after he left the Senate. I think he had just fulfilled all of his ambitions politically. And what's fascinating is he returned to his boyhood farm and became a gentleman farmer in those last 3 years of his life. He had a dairy farm. They do tobacco farming in Connecticut. He got devoted to that. And what's interesting about that is he hated farming as a youth. One of the things I haven't mentioned is that this is a rags to riches story. He grew up on a subsistence farm in rural Connecticut and really emerged from that out of obscurity into this national profile that he did have. But he elected to return to his boyhood farm and spent the rest of his days kind of going full circle, you know, back to his roots and farming. And he died at the age of 74 in 1932.
Now, let me ask you this. I know you mentioned he was kind of forgotten in your family. Was he forgotten in the state as well, or the state still remembered him?
You know, I did a book tour in Connecticut, and I was really, they rolled out the red carpet in his hometown of Simsbury, Connecticut, which is outside of Hartford. He's revered there. He left in his will over 3,000 acres of land that he had accumulated over his lifetime to become what's now called the McLean Game Refuge. These are acres of land that are pristine. They got virgin forest land in it. There's miles of hiking trails, tens of thousands of visitors a year. And his vision was that this land that he had loved so much during his lifetime would be available to the public in perpetuity for people to see nature as he did and how much he loved it. It helped him during this recovery period after he left the governor's office. He really had something of a mental breakdown after he left the governor's office, and he found nature to be very healing, and he wanted this to be made available to people. So that, along with monies that he left for various churches, hospitals, a assisted living center that still exists today, he's established in 1932, again, way ahead of his time. So he's very well known. The McLean name is still revered in Connecticut. And I think knowing the full story of his life, you know, the rags to riches element, the comeback story that emerges after he left the governor's office and regrouped. Now I think we just have a much fuller sense of the man and what the struggles that he had, that he overcame to do what he eventually did in the U.S. Senate.
Now, I didn't know his story before I met you, but I find his story very fascinating. And I know you said that when you were younger, or when you were a child, your middle name was the question of where it came from. Let me ask you this question. Does your middle name now have a different meaning to you as an adult and after having written this book than when it did when you were a child?
Yes, it does. I discovered a number of things about him that I really deeply admire and see within my own family. The value system that he had, the commitment to the perseverance to do what was right, the independence in thought that I noted. You know, I've often thought if I could ever meet him, you know, there is this kind of parlor game of, you know, what famous people would you want to meet and have dinner with? What would you ask them? In some ways, I would thank him. I would thank him for the life that he led, the integrity, the moral choices that he made. He was a very wealthy man, and yet he didn't live that way. He donated so much when he in his will to great causes, some churches, this game refuge. I would thank him for that. But something else I learned was that he became something of a surrogate father to my grandfather. My grandfather was virtually an orphan. And McLean, who didn't have children of his own, took him under his wing at a very young age and nurtured my grandfather. I know he paid for his college education. And those are things that I see in my family today, the commitment to family, the values, looking out for others. And I know that the values he instilled in my grandfather, not to mention the college education he provided, have ripple effects throughout my family. And so that's why I would say, rather than asking him a lot of questions, first, I would want to thank him for the life that he led and for what he did as a surrogate father to my grandfather.
Yeah, he sounds like a very stand-up character, for lack of better terms. The book is called Connecticut Yankee Goes to Washington. That's the short version of it.
Yep.
And it's available on Amazon. And where else can people get your book?
Yeah, I think Amazon is the easiest route. My publisher would probably love you to order from them directly, and that's Rochester Institute of Technology Press, RIT Press in New York. But Amazon is always if you got Amazon Prime or whatever, you can get free shipping. And it's the way that many people are getting it. It's available in some independent bookstores in New England. But it's those the best way, I think, is just a click on Amazon.
We're going to include the link in the description of this episode for our listeners and for our viewers, where you can purchase the book. Now, if someone wants to purchase a copy of the book, but a signed copy, is that a possibility that's available?
Well, you know, I'm happy to do that. All my book of appearances, I provide that. And I also, for my Zoom calls, I always say, hey, if you want to just email me directly, I'll send you a signed copy at a discounted rate. So that's another route. If someone would like that, I'd be happy to provide a signed copy, and just maybe they can get it through you, or we can have my email posted or something on your site.
Sure. If you want, we can put your email up. Now, let me ask you this. You did this book. You're on your book tour. You've living your first dream, as you indicated. Do you have any other projects in the near future that you're thinking of?
You know, Rush, I might not. This might be it. It came from my heart. It was such a labor of love, and it really didn't start out as a book. It started out as a way to uncover an untold story. And if I could find something comparable to that really fired my imagination and took me through 4 years of writing and rewriting and rewriting, I might do that. But I would not want to just write another book for the sake of writing another book. It would really have to be a passion project like this.
Right. I can understand. He's a family member, you know, he's your blood, and that makes it a work of love. I understand that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's just the writing process. You know, this is a 4-year thing. It was like 2 years of research, then I got a publisher, and literally it was almost 2 years of writing, rewriting. I always say that writing a book is a solitary experience, but publishing a book is a team effort that requires a lot of give and take. And that's what I experienced. And so there's a 4 or 5 year consuming effort that I've loved doing. And I would, if I could find another topic that matched that, I would probably go for it. But just to go through the motions of saying, hey, I've got two books instead of one, I'm not sure that that's what I'm looking for. Because this was really something that came from the heart. And I just really had a lot of emotion and motivation to write, let me put it that way.
Awesome. Again, Mr. Greeley is my guest, Mr. Will McLean Greeley. Connecticut Yankee Goes to Washington is the name of the book. We will include the link so you can actually purchase it, and we will include Mr. Greeley's email if you want to get a signed copy from him. Mr. Greeley, it was a pleasure. I really enjoyed our conversation and your book. I haven't read all of it. I read the description of it, the preface of it. It seems like it's a very interesting book. I'm going to have to find the time to go through it and read it.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. And I can just put one more plug in. It makes a great Christmas or holiday gift to the person who loves birding or American history. I'm finding a lot of people are doing things that way. We're starting already to think about Christmas comes earlier than ever. But appreciate your interest. And I really enjoyed talking to you about it. Your questions really resonated with me. And I want to thank you for spending time with me today to share this passion I have for this person.
Thank you. It was a pleasure having you on, and I wish you luck.
Thanks again.